I'm Iris McAlpin, and you're listening to Pure Curiosity, an exploration of the human experience and what it takes to be mentally healthy in our modern world. To begin, I would just love to have you introduce yourself. I know you have quite a story, and we will delve into that, but just maybe start with what you're up to now and where you live and your name and all of those good things.
Well, my name is Sean Alex Namath, and I live in Houston, Texas, and I am the founder and the CEO of the Chester Street Foundation. And I also continue to do some coaching and speaking, and I guess I'm an author now.
Yes, you are. Yeah, quite a powerful story.
Thank you. It was not an easy one to write.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah.
Well, let's start with, we're definitely going to get into that, but let's start with the Chester Street Foundation and,
okay.
You guys do.
Well, I guess I'll just give you a little spiel then,
Sure. Spiel it up.
We've just recently celebrated our 2-year anniversary in March. And as we continue to meet with credible people all across Houston who have worked for many years in child advocacy, we continue to receive confirmation on the importance of our mission. The mission of the Chester Street Foundation is to shine a light on the invisible wounds of childhood trauma so that abused children receive the treatment they deserve. I don't know if you're aware of this, Iris, but in the United States alone, there are over 3 million children who are abused and or neglected every year. 1 million of them, so much so that CPS has to intervene. And, you know, we at the Chester Street Foundation are grateful for all the organizations that work so courageously on removing these precious children from their abusive environments. But we also believe that this is just the first step. What many people fail to realize is that although a traumatized an abused child can be removed from an abusive environment, the trauma often remains. And when it's left untreated, you know, it can cause lifelong complications for these children. Nearly 1 in 3 American children ages 12 to 17 years have experienced 2 or more types of childhood trauma that are likely to affect their physical and mental health as adults. And almost half of our nation's children have experienced at least 1 or more types of serious childhood trauma. So we started the Chester Street Foundation to provide a voice for abused children and to educate our community on childhood trauma, particularly those on the front lines of the issue, like educators, caregivers, and healthcare workers. We currently have 2 programs out of the Chester Street Foundation. We have a community trauma talk program, and we have a trauma training for educators program. Our community trauma talk program is made available through public and private venues. It provides audiences with an overview of childhood trauma, helping them understand the science behind the emotional reactions to trauma and its signs and symptoms. And then our trauma training for educators program is a 3-hour workshop, which provides participants or educators with a personal and professional perspective of childhood trauma, along with small group interactions and practical problem-solving activities to work with traumatized children in a classroom setting. So, of course, all that information is available on our website and how people can get involved at chesterstreetfoundation.org.
I am so happy that you're doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
I mean, as I'm sure you know, like my area of expertise is working with developmental trauma, but I work with adults who have, you know, survive their childhoods and they're going out into the world and having difficulty functioning, or at the very least difficulty relating with people. And
there's such a need for that. There's such a need for what you do.
There is. And there's such a need for early intervention. And
yeah,
so it's just, you're totally speaking my language. And I think if people can be reached at an earlier age before some of these damaging personal narratives really sink their hooks in, then these children really stand a chance of escaping some of the darker years, I think.
Exactly. And really, Iris, that's why I started the foundation, because after going through my own treatment, you know, the 6.5 years of treatment, I came to the place of thinking, man, if I could have found this at a much earlier place in life, how different could my life have been?
Yep.
You know, I'm sure you've probably thought the same thing.
Certainly. Yeah. So let's talk about some of the things that you've experienced. I mean, I read your book, and I have to say it was challenging at certain points to read, because you went through some shit, for lack of better terms. You really did.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to me that you were able to come to a place of forgiveness, and that you're doing the work you're doing now. And I don't want to like skip ahead too much, but
sure.
I think where I'd like to start is just, what was it like for you to go back and commit those stories to paper and really put your experience out into the world and share what you've been through?
Yeah. It was difficult. It wasn't easy. I mean, it took me 3.5 years to write the book, and it was literally the most challenging, rewarding, grueling creative project that I've ever done. And I've done quite a few, you know, over my life. It was difficult. It was difficult diving back into those stories of my childhood, unfolding many of those pieces, stringing together those compartments that I had to keep separated in my, you know, in order to survive in my own head. But it was also, gosh, it was also incredibly healing for me. I think it was healing for me in knowing that I was giving that little blonde boy a voice somehow that never had a voice. And also healing in knowing that I was creating something that had the potential of helping many other people find their voice. It was a really interesting process for me, because, you know, I started the book probably, I had around 6.5 years of therapy. It'd probably be about 1.5 years before I finished the therapy is when I started writing the book. So I continued writing that book after I finished, you know, working with my therapists, the two therapists that I worked with.
And same was Iris, right?
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. But actually, for the sake of anonymity, I called her Iris in the book. Yeah, I was thinking about that when I talked with you.
That's funny.
How ironic. There were pieces that really unfolded for me that never even opened for me while I was in therapy, just from writing the book. And places that I went to that I never thought I could when I was writing the book. And yet I think what it came back to for me, Iris, was a conversation that I had with my therapist when I started writing the book. You know, she said, Sean, if you're going to do this, I really want to encourage you to really go for it and write it honestly. And I made that commitment not only to her, but to myself, that I was going to do that. And I'm sure you can probably see that I tried my best to write it in a very raw format.
Yeah.
Of what it was like for me, you know, to go through those places and through that hurt and that pain and that shame, not only as a child, but then how it affected me growing up as an adult.
Yeah. It's interesting, because I was thinking as I was reading, as I'm sure you've learned studying trauma, you know, when we have these really traumatic experiences, they often don't get stored as narrative memory. They get stored as fragments. And
Yes,
so I would think just the process of taking those fragments and putting them into narrative form and this cohesive story was probably one very difficult to do, but also incredibly healing just to have it fully come together.
Yeah, it really was because, and I think that's why it took me 3.5 years.
Makes
you
sense
know,
to me,
because when I would sit down to write a chapter, I usually had maybe 3 stories that I knew that I wanted, or 3 incidents that happened in my childhood that I wanted to unfold in that chapter. But I never really had the starting point or the ending point. I just kind of opened that door. And it was interesting because a lot of times when I started writing a chapter, I would have to put it down for a couple of months as memory after memory just started to flow. Things that I had forgotten about, pieces that I had forgotten about.
Yeah.
So it really, it was kind of bringing together those fragments and having to really find a way to put that into my own words and to describe what that was like for me. And then to try to do it around a story format so that it could really relate to the reader.
Well, you did a very good job.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate hearing that. It was really difficult for me to put that out into the world. And I think that you can understand that part of the difficulty was knowing that once that stuff's out there, you can't take that back.
Right.
And then what kind of issues are going to be around family that read the book?
I wondered about that.
Yeah.
How has that been for you? Let's dig into that.
Yeah, it's been challenging. I really took my time in how I presented the stories. And I think I can say with all honesty that I didn't, you know, I really dealt with the whole forgiveness part before I ever put that book out into the world. Because I wanted to make sure that my heart was in the right place, that I was, that I wasn't doing it out of anger, that I wasn't doing it out of judgment of my family or those involved, and that I was really doing it with a heart to want to take my story and use it to help other people. So first of all, that was a really important piece. And I really had to come to a decision before I released the book that all I could do was put my story out there. I had no control, and I still have no control over how people will respond. Mm-hmm. And I had to accept that, you know, before I put that book out there. And that has to do with my family as well. And the reactions have been mixed.
Yeah,
they've been mixed. I mean, I don't have communication still with my sister and with my mother.
Because of the book or because of other things?
Because of the whole process that led to the book. How about that? I mean,
the
whole, yeah, me getting into therapy and establishing the boundaries and saying, hey, I've got to dive into this and really deal with this. And, you know, with my mother, I had to say, listen, I completely understand. You've always said you don't want to go there. And I've always respected that. But for me, I've got to do this because I really feel like it came to a place where I believe it was an issue of life or death. And I think you probably saw that in my story in the book. You know, when I had that breakdown that, resulted in post-traumatic stress disorder and I had to be hospitalized. I mean, I was in a bad place, Iris.
Yeah.
And it was really hard coming back from that. And I knew that I had to really take the bull by the horn, so to speak, and really dive into it and work on resolving some of those things for myself. So it's been a mixed bag with family. I have reconnected with my grandmother, who I could tell, or I'm sure that you could tell through reading my book, was a major influential person in my life.
Yeah, huge.
And yeah. And I mean, she and I talk probably 3-4 times a week.
Oh,
She's 93 years old. And I probably have an intimacy with her that is deeper than what I've ever had before, because it's really based on a place of authenticity to a much greater degree than what I even had when I was younger. So it's been a beautiful thing.
I'm really happy to hear that. Yeah, she sounded like she was your safe haven for a long time.
She was. She was. And, you know, it's interesting because even after writing the book, you know, of all the research that I've dived into because of the foundation about trauma and around trauma, and I'm sure you probably understand, you know, this much more than I do with your area of expertise. But I remember reading something from Dr. Bruce Perry, who's a neuroscience specialist. And I remember reading some of his work where he talked about that even a child that was severely traumatized throughout their childhood, if that first year of development, they had someone that showed them unconditional love and really cared for them during that first year, it could really help them in the years ahead. And something that I found out through these conversations that I have with my grandmother, because all I have is phone conversations with her. So all I have is her voice. I'm not able to go see her because she lives with my mother. And so all I have with her are these phone conversations. But I learned during one of these phone conversations something that I never knew. And that is that my grandmother basically raised me as her own child until I was 1 year old.
Wow.
And then my mother, because my mother was 16 years old when she got pregnant. And my dad was 17. So when he came back from the service, she took me and moved out of her mother's house. I was 1 year old at the time, and that's where the abuse really started happening. So it's so fascinating to me to know, to have read that research, and it even drives home even more so why I had such a tight relationship with my grandmother, and what she did for me. She really probably in many ways helped save my brain.
So. Yeah, that makes so much sense.
Yeah.
And yeah, those early formative years are so critical. And I think a lot of times people dismiss the importance of that first year of life because we don't remember it. But there's so much happening in terms of brain formation and even like sort of primordial formation of identity at that time. And
yeah,
so it makes sense that you had that foundation.
Yeah. I think it really made a difference. I really do.
I'm curious, and I hope this is okay to ask, but it's just, it really was this consistent question as I was reading your story is, and I know she apologized to you at one point, but you know, how did your grandmother not really know what was going on? And I have some guesses as to why maybe she didn't hear you when you told her about it, but I'd be curious to hear your perspective.
Yeah. Do you know, my grandmother, and of course I've come to understand all of this through my own healing process more than the years prior. But my grandmother always lived under a huge amount of shame herself. And even, you know, again, through these conversations that I've had with her, you know, I learned of her own abandonment issues with her family, when she was younger, when her parents divorced and gave her to an aunt and uncle for them to raise. And, she really lived under so much shame. And I really learned that when she gave me this book of poems and songs that she had written. And I just saw the shame throughout those words, the deep shame, the deep-seated shame that she lived under. And it really helped to make sense to me. So many things about my grandmother that I never understood and why she so dove into religion. Because I think she felt like her life was out of control in many aspects. And that gave her a sense of it gave her a sense of hope and centeredness, I think, for herself. I think in terms of what she didn't do in helping me as a child. Well, for one thing, she has, you know, she did repent for that, yeah, like you said. And she's done so over and over and over. I mean, even over the last several years, she said, Sean, if I had to do it all over again, I would have taken you,
yeah,
and raised you on my own. I just don't know that at that time in her life, she had the strength to do it.
That makes sense.
I just don't know that her mind would let her go there. And I really think that that's so much of the same thing with my mother. I just don't know that her mind is able to go there.
Mm-hmm. It's too painful.
It's too painful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is why, you know, doing the work on ourselves is so critical. It's the only way to break these generational cycles, yeah, of trauma and shame.
It is.
And I'll just share a quick story just because it feels relevant, you know, for
Please.
Me. Mental illness definitely runs in my family. And when I started showing signs of depression and some PTSD, which was, you know, obviously not a generational thing, but my mom just couldn't accept that it was mental illness. She felt like it was her fault because it came from her side of the family. Mm. And so instead of getting me mental health treatment, I was taken to a million different kinds of doctors trying to address the physical symptoms that I was having rather than actually dealing with the root of it. And she and I have talked about this extensively. And you know, yeah, she really understands what was going on now. We have a great relationship. But at that time, it was just too difficult for her to acknowledge that that's what was happening. It was too painful. And so it kind of reminded me of maybe what your grandmother was going through as well, where it's,
yeah,
if we feel too triggered or too much shame by something, it can be much easier to just pretend it's not happening.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that's what continues to perpetuate these cycles in families. I mean, there's such a stigma around mental illness. I mean, there has been for so many years, and thank God it's starting to be addressed more so, but it still has a long way to go.
Yeah, it does.
And, you know, it's interesting that you say that because something that you don't know that happened since you and I chatted briefly before is that my biological father passed away.
Mm. Sorry to hear that.
And thank you. Thank you. And I had to make a decision if I was going to go up to the funeral or not in Michigan. And because one of my family members had a really difficult time with the book, especially mm. in what I wrote about, you know, with my dad's mother. And that, and let me tell you, that was one of the hardest parts of the book that I wrote about.
Yeah.
Because those were memories and things that really came out as I was writing the book that I really was faced with and wanted to be honest with.
Yeah.
And so when I went up to the funeral, It was difficult, Iris. It was difficult for me to see because I, you know, whenever I'm around my family, and particularly that side of the family, I'm confronted with the amount of mental illness mm-hmm. and addiction, and it's heartbreaking. It really is, and it just shows me how the cycles of, you know, trauma, abuse, addiction, mental illness, it just continues in this vicious cycle to where I don't even know if one could decipher where it began or how it began. It's just become this vicious cycle that continues and has continued for generations.
Yeah, I've thought about that a lot. And I think some of it, I mean, I think there are obviously genetic components, and this is just a theory of mine. I want to preface it with that. But I do think that we are such sponges as young people, and we are, it's sort of monkey see, monkey do. Like, we observe our caregivers, we observe our families and the people in our lives, and we unconsciously pick up on language and ways of being that we see demonstrated. And so if the language and the conversations that people are having are steeped in a lot of self-criticism or like criticizing others, if there's a lot of anger or hatred or any of those kinds of emotions encoded in the language on top of, you know, whatever ways of being and acting we see demonstrated, it's like we absorb those and we start to carry them, even if they weren't ours yes. to begin with. And so,
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you. And that goes right along with the research that I've been reading over the last several years on trauma.
So I'm interested because, you know, the odds were certainly stacked against you for yeah. coming out the other side of this the yes. way that you have. And you do talk about it in your book, but for those who are listening, how do you explain how you were able to come through to the other side and be able to be a force of love and hope and faith for people?
Well, it really happened in stages for me. I mean, you know, I'm sure you read in my book, you know, when I was 7 years old, walking past a church with my mother, mm-hmm. you know, walking down to the corner grocery store and we saw this church and I said, "Hey mom, can I go to church there on Sunday?" And I started to get myself up on Sunday mornings and walk down to that church because she gave me permission. And you know, she and my stepfather were usually passed out anyways. So they weren't even awake when I would get up. And that little church, you know, it was interesting because one of my therapists told me that she believed that that little church became an attachment for me.
Yeah, that made so much sense when I read that.
Yeah. I think for me, and gosh, it's so hard to explain and to put a finger on it, but I'm guessing that my grandmother had really imparted love into me. You know, she sang to me all the time. She read nursery rhymes to me. She was a very creative woman. And I think that really just ignited a fire in me to want more of that. And I went searching for it because I didn't get it from my family. I didn't feel loved. I didn't feel wanted. I felt very hurt and I felt like an outsider with my family. And so I think I there was something in me that drove me to go looking for that. Yeah. And I think, you know, the more that I'm diving into research about trauma, and again, just with a lot of Bruce Perry's research about how music and rhythm helps to regulate the brain. It's interesting looking at my story because I, you know, got into music at a very young age. I started performing in fifth grade, started singing and performing for audiences in fifth grade. And that continued until I was 31 years old. So, you know, I had rhythm around me. I was involved in rhythms and making rhythms. And it was interesting because I remember my first therapist, she started talking with me about rhythms and regulating the brain with rhythms and how some traumatized children would tap out rhythms. And it was fascinating when I heard her tell me that because I had completely forgotten that there were many nights in my childhood where I would literally lie in my bed and tap out rhythms on the wall next to me. So I found a way to regulate my brain. I was regulating my brain. That's how I was self-soothing myself.
That's fascinating. I'm surprised I haven't found his research because I had a similar experience with music that was sort of my safe place for a long time. Yeah, I started playing piano when I was a little girl and started singing and writing music. And music was a huge, I mean, until I was in my late 20s, I thought that was what I was going to do.
You know, that's fascinating. Yeah.
So maybe that was my lifeboat too, without really recognizing it as such, but that makes a lot of sense.
Wow. That's fascinating, Iris. Cause I mean, I'm starting to wonder because the more I'm reading his materials, I mean, he really believes that, you know, getting traumatized children involved in choirs, in theater, in some sort of music that is, or rhythm-based body movements, is incredibly important for regulating the brain. And when I look I mean, and I'm sure throughout my whole story, you read how I was involved in all of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, getting into the theater. I mean, I really had planned while I was in high school to go into a career of theater and was planning to go that route.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, too, because in a lot of underserved communities, people that don't have access to a lot of mental health resources, the church is often a prominent part of those communities, and music is a prominent part of church. So it makes sense.
Yes.
I never really put those pieces together. So that, thank you for that. That's,
well, I mean, it's really because, you know, it has been coming more to light, even for myself, you know, over the last couple of years in diving into this research. And I think, you know, that could be a major piece as well as why we're seeing such an escalation of violence in the schools today. Because for one reason, I mean, I really believe that untreated trauma is one of the core reasons why that's happening.
Absolutely.
But just think about it. I mean, in terms of what we've just discussed, if these self-regulating options are being removed from the schools, the music programs, the theater programs, the fitness programs, because walking is a way to self-regulate the brain.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it makes sense, doesn't it?
It really does. Yeah, because if you're dealing with whatever situation at home and you don't have the ability to burn off some of that steam to connect to your body, to connect to yourself, which I think music, as much as it takes you out of yourself, it's also a deeply creative process. And
it is.
So if that's taken away and you're just stuck sitting in your head all day long looking, you know, listening to lectures, that's not helpful.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, the number one most important thing for traumatized children is to feel safe in their own bodies.
Yeah.
And when they have no form of self-regulation, they're not able to feel safe sitting in school because many of them are being triggered. I mean, that's what happened to me. I mean, it was very difficult for me going through middle school because I could not stay present. I mean, I would sit in class and my mind was 1,000 miles away.
Yeah.
And when my teachers would call on me and I wouldn't even know what they were talking about. And then, of course, I'd be made fun of and I was getting bullied over that. And it just perpetuated the whole cycle of shame.
Yeah, I've wondered a lot about how much of what we diagnose as ADHD is really undiagnosed trauma. Because
trauma
really impacts our ability to focus.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, and that's what the research shows. I mean, the research shows that, you know, children who are being misdiagnosed with ADHD, post-traumatic stress disorder, bipolar disorder, that a lot of the times the root of that is trauma.
Yeah.
I mean, statistically, traumatized children, and this is a crazy statistic, Iris, traumatized children are statistically misdiagnosed 5 to 7 times throughout their life.
I'm not surprised.
And I remember hearing one mental health professional that came to hear me speak at one of our trauma talks. And she said, you know, hearing that statistic blows me away because I've learned through my training and experience that just one misdiagnosis for a child can completely change the trajectory of their life.
Yeah, it's really true. And it's kind of alarming. And one thing I do want to just define for people out there listening is that trauma, we often think of trauma as being the more extreme cases like neglect and abuse. But Bessel van der Kolk is a researcher that is at the forefront of trauma research. And he defines trauma as anything that overwhelms our capacity to cope.
Yeah.
And I've also heard another definition, Dr. Eric Gentry talks about it as an experience coded in terror. And so that covers a much broader range of experiences.
Yes.
And so
it does.
And something can feel life-threatening without being life-threatening as children, you know, our attachment relationships or, you know, social rejection can feel life-threatening.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I remember reading in the research of Dr. Peter Levine, and he talks about how, his whole thinking and research has showed that trauma sets in when an individual feels as though they cannot escape from the, and cannot move through the flight fight process. And he said that that is not only a physical, or that can happen not only in a physical sense, they can mentally feel as though they cannot flee. And that can also cause trauma to set in as well. And I think that goes right along in lines of what you just said.
And I just bring that to light because I think a lot of people listen. They think, oh, well, I've never been abused, so I've never been traumatized, or that doesn't apply to me. And I think we need to start recognizing that trauma has a much broader range
Yes,
than
yes.
people realize, and that even things that we might consider more subtle can have long-lasting or leave lasting imprints on us.
Absolutely.
So, something I really want to get into and was really intrigued by is that I think you mentioned you were a freshman in college when you called your parents and forgave them. And that's something that I know so many people struggle with, is the forgiveness component.
Yeah,
And for
yeah.
myself, that was a huge part of my healing. But I also think sometimes in self-development work, people are rushed to forgive and do so sort of prematurely. I see that happen quite a bit. And I'm just interested how you were able to get there by the age of 18 and really and what impact that had on your life.
Well, that's a great question. Nobody's asked me that before. Well, first of all, I'll say that forgiveness, I believe, is an ongoing process. I mean, I find myself, and I found myself even in writing that book, I had to continue to forgive because remember, new pieces were continuing to come out. New insights, new understandings, new memories that I had forgotten, new things that my mind wouldn't let me remember. For me, I really believe that my relationship with God had a lot to do with that at that time in my life. And when I was in college, I had this situation happen where I started opening up to a friend, and I believe I put that in the book, where I started opening up to a friend about my childhood, and it was way too much for that person to hear. It was a pastor, he was a pastor's son, and I thought, wow, this would be a great safe place to start, talking about some of my childhood. Well, that person lived a very sheltered life, so hearing about some of my childhood was just way too much for them. And so they decided to just, stay away from me for a period of time. And that obviously triggered something in my traumatized brain because I had what appeared to be a seizure one weekend. And the ambulance had to come and take me off to the hospital, and they ran tests on me and they couldn't find anything. Again, that's such a characteristic of trauma, physical issues and going in, being tested, and they can't find anything. And during that time, after that happened, is when I decided that I was going to go into the ministry instead of pursuing a career in the theater, in a musical theater, because it just threw me back into this place of feeling so out of control and needing a higher power. Feeling that I needed someone who was much greater than myself to help me through that period of my life. And I think a lot of those teachings that, that I had received when I was younger, sitting in church, resonated with me at that time. And I think there was obviously something that kept coming up to me and was really heavy in my mind at that time, for whatever reason, was the hatred that I carried towards my stepfather. And it was great, Iris. I mean, just in mentioning his name, I would feel, this, my body would literally shake. And I felt like I was going to pass out. And I knew that I had to address that. And it was during that period of time after being released from a hospital, being back at school, I really started getting back into church, and because I'd gotten away from that, and knew that I had to address some of those things because it was eating me alive, and I knew that if I didn't deal with it, it was going to be detrimental for me. And so, first of all, I dealt with it in my own heart, and wrote about it. And then I finally found enough courage to make that phone call where I called both of them, and neither one of them said too much over the phone.
Right.
But I can tell you that something happened, because the nightmares, so many of the nightmares that I was tormented with, there was one particular nightmare of my stepfather killing the entire family and leaving me for last. And do you know that when I made that phone call and forgave them verbally, that nightmare stopped?
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. I'm curious. I have a lot of questions, but what do you think it is? Because, I mean, obviously the nightmares are a classic sign of PTSD. What do you think it was, just in the act of acknowledging and forgiving, that it seems like it sort of tied a loose end in your brain, almost like it sort of closed a chapter?
You know, it did in some ways. You know, I want to be very honest in saying that the nightmares didn't continue. I mean, didn't completely go away after that.
Right.
They really continued on, in the sense of me finding myself always in a war type situation where I was fighting for my life.
Yeah.
And I was having to hide out, and that continued on. But the nightmare of my stepfather killing us did stop. Hmm. And I think, and I know that I was able to really forgive him, and forgive me if I'm not answering your question, and please bring me back on track if I don't. But I knew that something shifted, because when I saw him the next time after, you know, making that phone call several months later, you know, during the Thanksgiving, I think it was, when I went home for Thanksgiving or Christmas break, when I saw him, I didn't feel that sense of anger and hatred towards him anymore. It had lifted. I don't know that I can explain that, how that happened. And even with my mother too, I really felt like I had forgiven. And I could talk about my childhood after that and not feel that same, I don't know, there was just such this sense of hatred that I felt and carried with me, that was so crippling for me at times. And I felt like that had lifted. Now, it didn't stop the day-to-day struggles that I lived with because of the trauma, because of the characteristics of the trauma itself. But it did help in the way that I viewed them and held them responsible, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it absolutely does.
And I really believe that forgiveness, I mean, there is such a spiritual component to forgiveness. And I there was a lot of prayer involved in asking God to help me to forgive. Hmm. And that was involved in that process for me as well.
And how did they receive, because you hung up the phone before they really had a chance to respond?
You know, it was interesting, because when I went back home, I could see that there was a change with them as well. Hmm. Now they never said anything about that again, but I felt like there was a shift, because I'm sure there had to be an amazing amount of shame that my mother lived under. And I know she still does. And my heart breaks for that, because shame is a horrible, horrible monster. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that there had to be that amount or some amount of shame that was lifted because of that forgiveness. being extended to them. And you know, I've had to come to the place that I've had to recognize the mental illness in my stepfather and in my mother's life as well.
Yeah.
And recognize that, you know, some of the things that have been said and done over the years have come out of that. And I'm having false expectations if I expect someone to act and behave in a healthy manner if they're not well.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that answered your question,
yes, it totally does.
But it is something that I continue to have to walk through, Iris. It is, you know, like the response that happened with several family members after the book came out. My sister had a very difficult time and was saying things on Facebook and calling me a liar about the book and the things untrue that I wrote about. And, you know, so there again was another opportunity that I had to extend forgiveness.
That must be really difficult to finally have the courage to share your story and then to have people say that it isn't true.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you deal with that?
It's not been easy. And I think that was one of the reasons why, you know, I wanted to go up to Michigan to my dad's funeral. Of course, I wanted to be there for my stepmother and for my sister to support them through that difficult time. But I also did it because of putting my story out there, and I did it for myself as well. I wanted to see my family in my, you know, the extended family. And some of them that had a difficult time with the book, I don't want to run from my truth and cower from my story and put it out there and then try to hide and act like I didn't do that, which, you know, a lot of trauma survivors do that, who write books about their lives. The aftermath sometimes is too great, where trauma survivors will actually, you know, discredit themselves in what they said, because they become so fearful and they become so shut down and they become so rejected by their families that all of that is just too great to bear. And I had to do that for myself. And, you know, my partner went with me, my husband went with me, and that was good for me as well, you know, because part of that, a lot of that shame that I've lived under is part of being, it has to do with being a gay man as well, and a gay man who is a man of faith. Yeah. So that's a continual process, I guess, as well.
Yeah, I think it's important for people listening to hear you say that, and it's something that I certainly talk about a lot as well. It's just that you're never fully, or I don't believe that we're ever fully done processing. I think we can get to a place where life gets really good and we feel safe in the world and we're able to own our story, but that doesn't mean that things don't show up and that we don't have to deal with triggers and things like that.
Absolutely. It continues on. And I will give you a perfect example of that. One day I was sitting working at my computer and I saw a message pop up on my phone, and it was from one of the family members of my stepfather. Mm. And my hands literally started to shake. And this was about a year and a half ago. And I instantly reached out to a very close friend of mine who has walked with me through so much of this. And she just, you know, she said, "Sean, it's okay. You're safe now. Just erase the message and know that you're surrounded and people love you and people support you." And so even now, that still, you know, just like you said, it's still a process. It's a day-to-day process. And it's not an easy one when it comes to family. And I, even though it's difficult, Iris, I have every belief, and it's something that I pray constantly, that relationships will continue to be restored in my family and restored even, you know, with my mother and my sister and others in my family when the time is right and when we're able to do that in a healthy manner. And I try my best to keep judgment out of my heart. And to have faith that maybe one day those relationships could be restored. But I also understand that there are certain things that would have to happen in order for that to take place.
Right. Yeah. And I think something I've learned too is that, and I'm sure you've experienced some of this as well, is just that some people, it seems to me like the pain of dealing with it is just so, seems so much greater than the pain of holding on to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's just what they've been doing their entire lives. And it works as well as it works, but it's at least familiar.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
For a lot of people, it just seems like opening that.
Yeah.
That door, I think, is just overwhelming.
I think you're right. And I think there's something to be said that some people get addicted to that feeling and that pain too, don't they?
Certainly. Yeah.
It's so complex.
It really is.
We are complex.
Speaking of complexity, there's something that I wanted to bring up because it's a topic that's very interesting to me.
Okay.
And that is, you know, your ex-wife was somebody that mirrored a lot of the dynamics that you were used to. You know, she was constantly cutting you down and was, from what it sounds like, verbally abusive towards you. And this is something that happens a lot. And I notice this, you know, working with my clients and just doing outreach work, that those of us who've experienced trauma tend to recreate trauma in our personal relationships.
Yes,
and
yes.
I'm curious just to hear your experience with that and just speak to that phenomenon sort of from a personal level rather than a more clinical level.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, your questions are great. and challenging at the same time, which is good. I remember specifically sitting with my first therapist in her office, and it obviously was out of the conversation we were having that particular day. But I remember asking her, do you think that I have this pattern of being drawn to people, the same type of people in my life that are unhealthy? And it was like a light came on for me just in asking that question, where I could see that. I could see that the type of person that I had continued to be drawn to over my lifetime, and many of the same similarities that they had. And so I began to talk with her about, you know, things that I could do to begin to break some of those patterns for myself.
Yeah.
And that really kind of became a journey, my own personal journey, in wanting to make that happen for myself. And it was not easy. I mean, because there, you know, those relationships had codependency, you know, tied up in them, and people who were controlling, like my stepfather had been. And so I had to begin to take a look at all of those issues for myself, and how I let those things in, and how I could begin to break those. And it wasn't easy. And allowing myself to date people that didn't have those same similarities.
Yeah, it's tough, because I think in some ways playing the victim feels easier at times. I mean, I can just speak from my own experience. You know, I definitely had to face this realization that, you know, wherever you go, there you are. And
yes.
And I was having these repeated patterns in relationships, and that I was the common denominator in those relationships. And that was a really tough pill to swallow for me at first.
Yeah,
it was much easier to say, no, they're just crazy, or they're just bad, or they're just whatever, you know? And I think that's really difficult for people to look at.
Absolutely. And that's kind of where I was going with what I said, but you just said it in a much better way, is that, yeah, I had to really recognize that there was things in myself that was drawing me to these types of people. And I had to begin to really look at that seriously and take hold of that and take responsibility for my part, the part that I played in those things.
Yeah. And I think it's so appealing, this idea that we can flip the script, like that this time it's going to be different, or that, you know, this person, I can change this person, or I can help this person.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so often that doesn't end up happening.
But, yeah. Yeah. Gosh, I've had to work through so much of that. That's for sure.
And part of the reason this fascinates me is I don't really understand for myself, you know, why I was able to start to look at that and acknowledge my role in it, which sounds like, you know, you have absolutely done as well. I think maybe it's that same theme, that it's just too painful for people to recognize their role in it. But I bring it up because I want more people to be able to look at that and take that on, because it ultimately becomes very liberating when you realize you have some control in the situation.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, for me, when I got into treatment, Iris, I already said this before. I mean, I dove into it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you could say that I was the perfect patient and client, but I tried to be. I mean, in the sense that I really grabbed hold of what my therapists were working with me on and really worked to apply it in my life, because I really wanted to grow and make movement forward. And I came to a place where I learned that it didn't matter how I got where I was. I was there.
Yeah.
At that point, I had to take responsibility for where my life was, the relationships in my life, the abuse and the trauma that I came out of. I had to take responsibility for that. And I had to do what I had to do to move myself forward. I had to forgive myself. I had to forgive others that played a part in all of that. But I also had to really make a decision that I was going to do whatever I had to do to move my life forward instead of playing the victim.
Yeah.
And that's not an easy thing for most people to do. And it wasn't easy for me either.
So if somebody's listening to this and is sort of on that precipice and is wanting on some deep level to take this on, but has been really scared, what would you say to that person?
You're worth it. You're worth it. And your life is worth it. And there's so many great things ahead for you. Just believe, have faith, walk it one day at a time, put one foot in front of the other, open up your heart, and believe that you are worth it.
Yeah, I fully echo that.
Yeah.
And the other thing, I'm sure you come across this in your organization and probably also in your ministry, you know, for people that don't have that backbone of faith.
Yeah.
I was one of them. I have become a very spiritual person over the years, but I was very much not for quite a long time.
Yeah, I get that.
And felt super alone in the universe, and that made it a little more challenging for sure. And so if there are people that come to you and don't have that foundation of faith in a higher power, I guess I'm interested to hear what you notice with that. Is it harder for those people, or are there other ways that you see they're able to find?
Yeah, a lot of times it is harder for people who are unwilling to acknowledge that there's something bigger and greater than themselves involved in their lives, or who wants to be involved in their lives. You know, with my coaching clients, usually where I go with first, if I encounter an individual like that, is I first start to work with them on gratitude.
Mm.
Because I feel like there's nothing, and I've learned personally that there's nothing that connects me with my higher power more than practicing gratitude. And so I encourage them to get a notebook and to write down three things every day that they are grateful for. And that really can begin to plant the seeds for spirituality in their lives and finding a way to connect with something and someone that's much greater than themselves, because they're going to start to see that they're writing down all of these great things that are happening in their lives, maybe even in the midst of so much hurt and pain.
Yeah.
That something is happening and that someone else is involved in their lives and cares about them. So that's kind of where I see as a starting place with people who are struggling with spirituality. And though I say I have faith in God and I'm a spiritual person, which is all true, I also know that religion in itself can be very harmful.
Right.
And I'm sure you saw that throughout my entire story, and that's a whole conversation, a whole different conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, that was certainly true for me, where, you know, I grew up in Houston and went to a Baptist school, and it was a lot of hellfire and brimstone, and everyone's going to hell. And so I kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater and just decided that, you know, there was no God, and really went hardcore down that path for a while. And was just like, I guess I was worshipped in a church of science for a long time.
Yeah. It's understandable. Yeah,
it's interesting because the more I learn about science, the more I realize we're making a lot of inferences on, I guess more accurately, I should say, we just don't really know what the hell's going on in a lot of cases.
When it comes to
our understanding of the universe or even the human brain, there's just so much we don't know. And
so much we don't know. Yes.
I just sort of choose to just take that little leap of faith, and it makes me feel better, and I genuinely feel that way, but, you know, it took me a long time to get there.
Yeah.
So I feel like we could probably talk for a few more hours, but since we don't have a ton of time, there was just one other thing I wanted to ask you about, which is imposter syndrome. Because I remember, I think it was, you were working for the Institute, and I'm blanking on the name, and you felt, you know, it was this prestigious job opportunity, and you mentioned feeling like an imposter there. And I know that imposter syndrome is something that so many people deal with and have that experience of, if people only knew, you know, they wouldn't want me here. So how did you deal with that?
Ah, boy, what a great question. Wow, you're full of them.
Thank you.
You know, that's interesting that you bring that up, because that's something I still struggle with on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
And I went back and had an afternoon walk with my second therapist, just to meet up with her. It wasn't, you know, in an office setting. We just went for a walk just to touch base. And it was probably a couple of years after I'd finished working with her. And it was brief, maybe 20, 30 minutes. And I remember her asking me that question. She said, "Sean, do you still feel like you're an imposter?" And I said, "Yeah, I do. I do still feel that at times." And she said, "My friend, I don't know if that's something that will ever fully go away, but it will get easier over time." And that's the first time I've thought about that. I never even shared that with anybody. And now I'm sharing it with you and all your listeners.
Well, thank you for sharing that.
Well, thank you for asking the question. But I just don't know if that's something that for some of us will ever fully go away. But I think that as we become more comfortable, and what's helped me, I think, is as I become more comfortable in my own skin and I become more comfortable with who I am and how I got where I am. That lessens.
I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, it is a tricky one. And yeah. I think my sort of sense of it is that, you know, for those of us who've kept secrets for a long time and have yeah. had experiences where we share with somebody and it's too much for them or it's too scary or they're disgusted or whatever the case may be, it sort of reinforces that idea that if people really know me, then
yeah,
they're going to go away.
And absolutely. Absolutely. And I'll tell you that putting that book out for me really did help with a major portion of that.
Mm.
Because I, you know, there was so much of that in my book were pieces that I hadn't even talked about to a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And so putting that out there, there was at the same time, it was, I mean, it'd be, even although it was very difficult and challenging, at the same time, there was such a sense of relief and the sense of being finally, you know, being heard.
Mm.
And understood, because I was able to really communicate that for myself, that story, my life.
I'm curious if you've had sort of the same experience where I find it's a really great filter in a way that the people that can relate and the people that have compassion or the people that want to have understanding or maybe have experienced similar things themselves, that those relationships get stronger than the people that just for whatever reason don't want to go there, they drift farther apart and sometimes silently, sometimes loudly. But that the people that stick around, those relationships are incredibly strong, much stronger than they would have been otherwise.
Yeah, I've definitely found that to be true. For sure. I mean, there have been those that I have grown closer with through the whole experience and through the journey that I've walked and that I'm walking currently. But I've also definitely seen those that have turned away and have fallen away for whatever reason. And it's interesting because when you start talking about trauma and you start bringing these things up, and I'm sure that you experience this as well, there are some people that just do not want anything to do with that.
Certainly.
And they don't want anything to do with authenticity, you know, this talk of being authentic and talking about, you know, our inner challenges and the struggles that we've gone through. I even had one person tell me that I thought was a friend of mine at the time, you need to write a second version of your book. Your book was just way too graphic and way too difficult to read. And I think you need to write a second version that's much easier to read since you've started the foundation. And that can be the book that you associate with the foundation to make it easier for people to digest.
Mm.
And I was like fascinated with that because, you know, coming from this individual who was an extremely educated individual, had been very successful over his career, that he came to me with that idea that I should write a watered down version of my book because the subject matter was just too difficult for people to wrap their heads around.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting because I wondered about that because I think, you know, if somebody didn't have a trigger warning given to them, it could be really difficult for some people to read. But I also think for people that haven't experienced abuse or trauma on that level, it is very eye-opening. And so,
and that's the person that I wrote it for. I wrote it to be able to help people on their journey and to encourage them on their journey. And so, you know, I had to stay true to the audience that I was writing the book for and to myself.
Yeah. And I think that's really in some ways, the most important thing for us as healers to be able to share truthfully our experience and
people
will respond how they respond.
Yeah, exactly. And I've been working on another book that's a book of quotes, so I'm sure it will be a much easier book to read for people like
Right.
that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so for people that are interested in learning more about you and the work that you're doing now, where should we send them?
To ChesterStreetFoundation.org. Yeah.
And do you still take clients on, or
I
are you?
do. I do. I do still work with a small group of personal coaching clients. And of course, they can contact me through my email, Sean at SeanAlexNamath.com. And I do speaking engagements. So through the foundation and then also keynote speaking on my own.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. There's so much we could have continued
Yeah.
to get into, but
Yeah.
I really appreciate you being willing to share your story with so many people and for the work that you're
Absolutely.
doing in Houston. As a native Houstonian, I really am grateful that there's more happening in the mental health space in that city. So thank you for doing that.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure, Iris. Thank you.